Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
He understood and exploited elements of politics that were right there in front of everyone, but people either didn't see or they didn't want to do. And in 94, he becomes Speaker of the House, and he brings his style to the leadership of the GOP rather than it remaining on the sidelines. And he understood parts of politics. He understood how the 70s and the 60s had created immense distrust in politics. And he used that against Democrats. While Democrats talked about Nixon, he talked about congressional Democrats and said they were a corrupt establishment. And he understood how that argument would really resonate.
We have an amazing episode for you today. We are joined by Professor Julian Zelizer. He is the author of Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and The Rise of the New Republican Party. I actually read this book on, well, listened to this book on Audible about a month ago because I'm obsessed with the topic of how do ambitious politicians respond to a broken political system? So what happens when you have politicians who understand that there's an audience, that there are voters of people who think there's corruption, who think there are problems in the country? How do they take that situation and use it to their own political advantage? And then what happens to the country when their political ambitions either are or aren't aligned with what we're all trying to do here?
Yeah, I really enjoy talking with Julian. Most importantly is this, we're both obsessed with, like, why do our politics suck? Gingrich is a huge part of that story. And the weird part that comes out of this episode is that he was kind of a genius. He was really smart. And he was smart in a way that definitely made our country worse off. But somebody had to do it at some point. And so seeing where the incentives lie within the political system, it's going to explain a lot about who the political stars of are today.
It's pretty clear that we disagree with Professor Zelizer on a couple of things, but I think the most important disagreement that we both probably share, and I want everyone to think about as I listen to this episode, is it's one thing to argue Congress is broken, but I think if you're on the left and you're arguing it's broken, your case can't simply be that your own priorities can't get enacted. So you can't just come and say, hey, Congress is broken, the Republican Party is terrible because we can't pass climate change legislation and we can't pass the Green New Deal and we can't pass gun control, aka you can't get what you want, therefore the system is broken and everything has to be changed. I think the case has to be made much more coherently and much more broadly wide-facing than that, because that's, I think, that's the principal thing that we all just disagreed on.
No, absolutely. Okay, so you guys know the drill. Make sure you give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That's how you guys can ask us questions. It really helps other people find the show, and it's just kind of fun. In order to see those reviews roll in, go ahead and do that. You can sign up for the Realignment Substack and check out the Realignment Bookshop, where you can buy either the professor's book or any book that you want. It helps an independent bookstore during these hard times, and it helps our work here at the Realignment. So let's get to the question and answer period.
Today's question comes from Apple Podcasts, and it is a question that we forgot to answer. So thank you, MF Dubs, for emailing us with a screenshot so we can get back to it. But here it is. Here's an issue I've rarely seen brought up. Universities and companies, to a lesser but still significant extent, receive massive federal subsidies and grants. And these grants often directly fund highly partisan CRT studies, in quotation marks, which are then used as a basis to push leftist policy. With the understanding that private organizations have freedom of assembly, shouldn't the acceptance of federal government funds carry some restrictions, or at least some guarantee that the recipients won't be used to discriminate on race, as I believe many universities do? Would welcome your guys' thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm generally kind of in agreement with that. I think where things get dicey is that in general, then, it's all just going to become a general power struggle, and you have to be very careful about where that leads. If you were to ask me why I hate our politics, it's because of that. Most people are full of shit whenever it comes to an issue like censorship, right? Like, you'll see, like, Ron DeSantis talking about how people shouldn't be deplatformed and then celebrates whenever one of his enemies on Twitter is taken off. By the way, this is an enemy I exposed on my show and said was a charlatan, but that doesn't mean that I'm happy that she's being taken down. And whenever you see a lack of consistency in our politics, it becomes a race to the bottom over power. And also, I have news for a lot of conservatives out there. You are not powerful. It's the opposite of power. And your only hope is probably relying on some sort of principle going forward, given the state of the demographics and Republican Party today. What do you think, Marshall?
Yeah, here's the key thing. I think people too often, and I appreciate the question, MF Dubs, but I think people too often think of federal funding as a cheat code, as in, hey, I don't like this thing that's happening at universities or at a company or at a defense contractor. Therefore, let's just posit that it's possible just to restrict funding based on this very specific thing to get everything we want done. Think about it this way, right? Let's say, you know, I'm from Oregon, I went to the University of Oregon. I'm sure at U of O, there's some type of CRT-based class, which I could see a conservative opposing. Do you actually think it's plausible that the federal government, if it's millions, if not billions of line items, would be possibly able to go through the Oregon curriculum and then make some type of determination that, oh, this crosses a line and this is too far, therefore we're going to restrict your funding? That just doesn't, you say it out loud, and that just makes absolutely no sense to me. The reality is that most of these educational issues are actually adjudicated at the state level. So if you actually have beef with the curriculum of public schools in your state, whether at the university level or the K-12 level, maybe it's a school board, that's where that gets fought out. But I just think it's ridiculous to think that it would all be sustainable in the long term enough to change policy to use the federal government that way. I think that just goes, I'm opposed to it morally, honestly, but I also just think on a practical level, it wouldn't work. I mean, at best case scenario, let's just say you could do it. Trump somehow manages to restrict some research funding to a public school based on CRT, and then Biden comes in and restores the funding because it's just this partisan back and forth thing. So that doesn't help anybody.
Well, here's what would actually happen. Trump would say that he was going to do it, and then his idiot staff wouldn't do it, and then Biden would just triple it. And so that's actually how it would play out in practicality. So don't discount what it actually looks like when the right are mostly a bunch of professional morons. Okay, you guys have heard me go off long enough. Let's get to the episode. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it.
Professor Zelitzer, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be with you.
Good to see you, sir.
So this show is called The Realignment. The underlying idea is that the country, institutions, actors, figures, all of that is shifting, it's changing. So beginning with this, you're a historian. History is obviously used and abused in different directions. How should we think of applying historical examples and events to our current moment, given the fact that in many ways, the events that we are describing occurred in a different country? So for example, a country, not just along racial lines, but the parties were different, the coalitions were different. How should we think of using history today?
Well, I think there's different ways. One is to try to understand when things happen that seem unprecedented or exceptional, to ask the question, is that true? Or is this some kind of phenomenon that you've seen before in American history that is pretty deeply rooted and happens all the time, and using history to answer that very basic question. A second is to understand the roots of what's going on. I think there's a tendency in the media to imagine that everything starts today or maybe a year or two ago. And most of the big stories we talk about have been brewing at a minimum for decades, if not longer. And I think part of what you do with history is to try to understand how we got here and how the foundations of how we got here give us some guidepost to what we need to do to move forward or to stay in the same place, whatever your perspective. And so those are two of the ways I think it's very useful to think historically.
Yeah, it's fascinating whenever you think about history and you read about some of the same places. And, you know, even though we're relatively young, even still growing up, you can remember things in the 90s. I barely can remember some of the 90s, like when we were kids. And I'm like, man, that was totally different. It was like a totally different country. And thinking and trying to apply lessons from the 70s to today, It's really interesting in order to think like, yes, you know, things were fundamentally different, but some of the fundamental dynamics are the same. So if we were to look and use your book and a lot of your work and tie it together, some of the current events, for example, like we have right now with our economy, I mean, in terms of inflation and how that impacted our politics, how would you caution or talk to people who are thinking about inflation through a political lens today? Because people like Marshall and I have literally just never lived through any sort of sustained inflation in our entire lives.
And quick thing to add to this, just to give context, because this is probably a phenomenon of us being on Twitter too much. You'll see a tweet about inflation and you'll have people say, hey, right, it's Jimmy Carter again. Hey, we're back in the 70s. Yeah. All these different issues. So how should we think about the discourse around inflation and how that affects today?
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable that you haven't lived through a period of high inflation. That in itself is pretty notable, in that certainly since the 1970s, a decade where this was a major problem throughout the decade, as well as unemployment, it's abated and it hasn't been part of our discourse in the same way. But now it might be coming back. I mean, the first question is proceed with caution to really see if inflation is about to go sky high, if it's going to accelerate very quickly before draconian steps are taken. That's an important question for policymakers to ask. Or are you seeing some increases in prices, but not the 1970s? Overreaction is often as dangerous as not being proactive enough. And the second is, when inflation happens, in the 70s, we saw it puts political choices on the table that aren't clear in terms of what to do. In the late 70s, starting with Carter and then under Reagan, the government took pretty big steps to fight inflation, but they often came at a very high cost. Cuts to social services in cities that really hurt the quality of urban life, cuts to social safety net programs. And I think those are the kinds of questions, if inflation actually reaches those levels, that will have to be front and center. And we learn in the 70s how those can play out.
Mm-hmm. So speaking, as Sagar set up, as two hosts and much of our audience who didn't grow up during the 70s, would you compare the 2020s to the 1970s in any way? So how should we think about that? Because it's a weird lost decade. Culturally, politically, there's all these wishy-washy stuff, so it's unclear where we take from it. You have the Vietnam War ending, Nixon, all of that stuff. How should we think of the comparison?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The economy was really in terrible shape in the 1970s, not for a year, but for the entire decade. And we, again, had a really odd phenomenon that we were dealing with, inflation, unemployment at the same time, which in the 70s, most economists said could never happen. You had one or the other, and we had both, and it was called stagflation. And so Americans were increasingly out of a job, and at the same time, prices for everything were going up. And on top of that, there was a recurring oil crisis that they had to deal with. I'm not sure we're there today. And one of the remarkable things, and we'll see, is what effect the pandemic will have. I mean, a year ago, go back to that, I think there were very reasonable predictions. This would be devastating to the economy. I mean, you can't shut down an economy and not expect to go into a total depression, worse than the 1970s, something you can't recover. But we don't know. I mean, there's some signs the economy's recovering pretty fast. And if the vaccinations continue to accelerate, it might not be the 70s. We might be on a much steadier pace, some inflationary increases, but not catastrophic. Unemployment is still relatively contained in most parts of the country. And so I'm not sure it's the 1970s yet. I think that would be a leap, that it might be too quick to make that leap.
Yeah, I've said before, it's this strange amalgamation of the 1990s. It could be in terms of our economy, in terms of a return to our politics where everything is kind of driven by culture, but everything else is pretty like fundamentally sound, or at least seems sound, making some of the fights in our politics seem kind of removed from the life. That's how you have a Bill Clinton who, admired in a sex scandal, also has like a 65% approval rating. Like, I can't even imagine something like that happening. But also, it could be a roaring 20s. People have talked about the 1910s. Like, how, as a historian, where would you place the different elements of our cultural political life in terms of the context of American history?
Well, I think we're still living with some of the debates from the 1970s. So, you know, one question is this the 70s? Is it the 20s? I never know how to answer that because it's not. It's the 2020s, and that's what it is. But for example, some of the debates that the conservative movement, which took hold in the 1970s, put on the table about culture, about education, about rights, social rights, about the value of government in American life, we are still right in the middle of that debate. And I think a lot of the template for public discourse continues from that very volatile decade. In the 70s, distrust in government became a very powerful phenomenon, and distrust in all institutions, frankly. Distrust in universities, distrust in even to some extent the courts and business. And I think we still live with a lot of the aftermath of that today. I think that's part of what you are encountering in parts of the country where they don't even want to be vaccinated from this terrible pandemic because they just don't trust anything anyone tells them. So for me, it's not, is it the same, but I can see the consequences and the polarization in American politics that we often talk about, this very stark red-blue divide over what American life looks like, that started in the 70s with changes in the parties, changes in the politics. So for me, that's how I would connect the two decades rather than trying to find a roadmap that will tell us what the next 2 years will look like.
Right.
I think that's such a useful way to put it because as I'm just thinking of the 70s comparison, it's really what you said. There's themes that rhyme. So the theme of polarization, the theme of cultural issues, and then a theme of, I mean, that's the Jimmy Carter quote, the malaise, the lack of trust, the funnily enough, there's this weird dynamic where people talk about how the establishment is rigging everything, but you could definitely say this is probably the weakest and least confident the establishment has ever been ever, in comparison to the real heights of the 40s and 50s and 60s, where there's all this confidence in the ability. And we'll get into this a bit with LBJ and the Great Society, but we have just never gotten back to a world where I think you have a elite or an establishment that thinks it actually can do stuff like that. But I think another good thing to talk about in this context then is, frankly, New York City, because New York City is huge today. Obviously, the mayoral election occurred last week and you had Andrew Yang attempt to win. He obviously didn't. Looks like Eric Adams is going to win. How should we think of what happened in New York last week in terms of looking at politics in the 2020s, because what's so useful is so much in the 70s was tied to New York, whether it was the city just basically effectively running out of money and needing the government to attempt to intervene in some ways, the debates over crime, all those different parts. So how should we think of New York today?
Yeah, well, we're replaying in New York many of the same debates. I think that's fair to say. Again, it's very different, but a feeling of the economy just being incredibly fragile or having fallen apart, so to speak. I think in New York in particular, that's how the pandemic made things feel, because you had businesses literally shutting down. You have terrible revenue problems that the city is facing over a long-term basis and the need for federal assistance, which is exactly what was going on in the 1970s. And the potential, as you saw in the 70s, it's a different set of players, but that the economy might undergo some big changes in the city. Older industry leaving and in this case, physically relocating as a result of new conceptions of work. You had the issue of crime in the 1970s front and center. All you need to do, if you're not a historian, is to watch movies from that period, like Taxi Driver, yep, to see how the fears of the street were pervasive, and that became a political problem. And then finally, a thirst for leadership in a city that was struggling was paramount. And that was never really solved in the 70s. Ed Koch becomes one of the figures who kind of is a seasoned politician, but can't inspire that kind of leadership. And the city's going through that today. So if you're just talking about a crisis feeling, a crisis mentality, and long-term structural questions about how does the economy recover and how do the weaknesses in the economy, racial disparities, economic disparities, also part of the 70s, are they addressed or do we just move to recovery with all these issues basically put aside? I think that's what we're going through today. The big difference is back in the 70s, in New York, there was still a pretty robust middle class. Housing was still more affordable. It was a city that wasn't totally divided between very rich and very poor. That's where the city is going into the pandemic. And so it raises different kinds of questions as the next mayor, who, if it's Eric Adams or someone else, we'll see when this is all done. That's a big kind of difference in what they're facing.
Obviously, we don't know the results, but we do know that Andrew Yang didn't win. Right. And I know that you wrote a little bit about Andrew Yang. I've spent some time with him, covered him for a long time now. And it's a big question of what the hell happened. He was at the very top of the polls. This was an outsider candidate. It seemed uniquely tailored in the beginning. I'm curious if you agree to bring that kind of political leadership in this like weird lost de Blasio age where it seemed like everybody could kind of agree that everyone was like okay with how he was doing, but they didn't necessarily like what he was doing or they didn't like him as a figure, kind of similar to Ed Koch. And then his campaign just evaporates essentially within the span of a single month. What do you think it was? Is it just Eric Adams' relentlessness, discipline, message discipline whenever it comes to crime? Was it, you know, the stratification of the field, the progressives, and Catherine Garcia with PMCs? What happened here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm one who thought that he had more potential than some others did. I saw the appeal of someone who is an outsider. I saw the appeal of someone who does have instinctive leadership quality. And I think people underestimate why people like that kind of excitement about what he's doing and about the city. Look, part of it was this ranked choice. It was a very divided candidate slate. And so it was extraordinarily difficult. And it's not clear that, you know, as the split started to happen, that he really had the strength of support that could match where the polls were. So that's one. I think two is it's a little bit what we saw with Democrats in 2020. When a city is really scared and when residents are incredibly uncertain about where things are going and how do we fix things, I think there is a tendency to value experience and have some kind of safety net in your choice of leader. And he does not fall in that. He's a risk. Right. And I think for a lot of New Yorkers, they didn't want that risk. And in some ways, the crime issue, part of it is fear and obvious concerns about going on the streets and your kids, et cetera, et cetera. But part of it has become symbolic of, can we avoid the 70s again? Can we kind of keep the city in the place it's been for two decades, very safe, very livable, where those concerns are not paramount. And I think he fell away. And, you know, Eric Adams, in some ways, you can compare to Joe Biden. He's a safe choice. He's a politician. He knows the system. With good and bad, you kind of predict what he wants. And finally, old-fashioned politics matters. I mean, Instagram, social media, that's all important, but getting endorsements from unions, building coalitions, what Adams is very good at, apparently, is, you know, going to the churches and meeting people in a different way than Yang does. I think he kind of brought a lot of that together. And I think I think all of that kind of played against Yang. Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting here is I wonder if you were a up-and-coming politician, and this gets to our Newt Gingrich conversation in a bit, something we're both really fascinated by is, how do politicians shape themselves within the broader zeitgeist or narrative? So if you're a politician, a lot of folks are thinking, okay, hey, so Trump ran in 2016, agree with him or not, his win demonstrates that you can in many ways go against the establishment, go outside the system. Bradley Tusk, whose firm ran ran Andrew Yang's campaign said explicitly on his podcast, Andrew Yang's candidacy is a test of whether or not you can just go around the establishment, go around the traditional political figures and machine and everything. What do you think? Does this loss invalidate that idea, or is it basically just a wash? Because like you said, Eric Adams in many ways was built in a factory to respond to a 2021 New York.
Well, I think of it differently in that one of my arguments I've made is that Donald Trump wasn't as far away from the Republican establishment as people said. And we're seeing that the Republican establishment wasn't what people said it was. Many ways back in 2016, Jeb Bush was the outlier, not Donald Trump. And the way social media works and the way Fox News worked and the radicalization of the Republican Party meant Trump was, you know, personally, he was certainly not standard, and he came from outside formal political paths, but he actually fit pretty well with where Republicans are. And that's what we learned during his presidency, that Republicans generally liked him. He fit with the party in terms of policy and in terms of the way he governed. And so there, it's a case where actually the establishment mattered. It was just a different establishment than we thought. And so if you think of it that way, I do think that might have something to say in New York politics. It's not the case that you can just run from outside the system very easily, that you could be totally disconnected from the party that you're running in and win. There has to be some connection and continuity with the party if you're going to be successful. And maybe that's part of what Yang discovered.
That's so interesting, because I really appreciate what you just said about Trump in many ways better reflecting the ideology, the priorities, the rhetorical style of many people who were base voters of the party. What does what you're saying mean for Democrats? Because I think a good way of summing up what Trump did, and whether or not this was the Steve Bannon plan or whether this just happened, there's so many contradictory stories there, but it's best for us not to psychoanalyze. But in many ways, what Trump did is Trump ran against candidates whose positions, framing, didn't reflect the actual desire of the party. So the Republican Party did not want a third Bush presidency. They weren't too hot about the Iraq War. They weren't all about Paul Ryan, Social Security, privatization, all that stuff. In the Democratic side, then, if you think about how outsider candidates would make their arguments, what do you think is a priority of like the Democratic Party's base or a aesthetic that Democrats are looking for that outsider candidates could try to go after to run against? Because I'm trying to think of how you could compare these two situations.
It's very hard. I mean, my sense is Democrats, many Democratic voters right now, and in the last few years, are not necessarily thirsting for big ideas. What they're thirsting for is maintaining power. I think a lot of Democrats are cognizant, voters, politicians, that the Republican Party has really moved far to the right, to the extreme side of the political spectrum, and that the Republican Party is willing to play hardball in a way most Democrats have not been. You see that with the voting suppression tactics, for example, and you see that with debates over the filibuster. And on the one hand, you could say, well, that means Democrats want bold, big ideas. But I think a lot of Democratic voters just are like, no, we just have to make sure there's some stability right now and that we can maintain a majority in Congress and that we're not totally wiped out by these tactics. And so I think if an outsider, I mean, this is something I've just watched. If an outsider isn't aware of that, I think they're going to have difficulty. So that means they do have to, at some level, connect to basic political concerns about winning majorities in Congress. They have to have some sense of how ideas are actually going to happen. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, national health care for all. It's another to say, well, how do you get that in a Senate where Republicans aren't going to vote for that and they're going to filibuster that? And I think voters are a little practical in the Democratic Party, more so than the GOP.
See, it's interesting, though, because I think all of this comes down to another core theme of your book, which is political vision and leadership and being able to see vision in order to have a vision of where things should be or to intuit what is not being served. Mm-hmm. And look, this is actually value neutral. Like I would say Newt Gingrich is an example of somebody who's like, hey, this is what the GOP base actually wants. We're going to give it to them. We're going to go all in. May have changed American politics forever. I think Trump is exactly the same way. This is not necessarily a good thing for the entire country or for parties or whomever, but this is ultimately what good politicians do is they intuit what things are not being served and what are. So if we were to look at structural reasons, why do we not have great politicians these days? This is just, I think, a general observation. I mean, there's a lot of LARPing about this online, like, oh, our elite institution. It's all true. I mean, look, I think it's all bad. I don't think that we produce good leaders anymore. But from your perspective, you teach at one of the largest, most prestigious credentialing granting institutions in the world. Like, why are we do not see better politicians that are coming out of our elite production today?
Just Sagar, can you define what you mean by better politicians?
Yeah, I just don't think that we have politicians that are, I mean, to Julian's point, you can either blame this on politics or not, but I mean, you read Robert Caro's book, seemed pretty divided in the 1960s. I don't know, like, you know, civil rights didn't seem so easy in 1955, happened 10 years later. You know, JFK coming in, starting the moon program. Even Richard Nixon was, look, you can say what you want about the guy, a pretty good politician. I don't see that same level of like foresight or intuitiveness about how to work the system, about how to connect with voters and more. And I don't think we've seen in like, what, 20 years, 30 years? And I just don't know what's going on. I know it's a big question.
it's a good question. I'd say I'll start by saying not everyone will agree with you. And yeah. Let's start with that comment by Marshall. I'm assuming that's part of, some would say Barack Obama was that kind of leader and we had a leader like that. Okay, but let's put that aside and others can have that debate. Why might it be harder now to get the same number of exciting visionary politicians if you don't think they exist? I mean, I think certainly since the 70s, this goes back to the conservative revolution, the animus toward government has been extreme. And that was a basic argument of Ronald Reagan, Newt Gingrich, and others. Government at some level is a bad thing. Elected officials, like who wants to do that? They're fundamentally corrupt and the government is corrupt. And if you have generations of that kind of thinking take hold in large parts of the electorate and even win over Democrats at some level, you're going to alienate some younger people. And a lot of younger people, when they're looking at, should I go into politics as a vocation? As did LBJ's generation. It was something, yeah, they were proud to do. Even Republicans were very proud to spend a life in Washington. That's not the culture we live in anymore. You know, it's almost something to be endured going into that kind of job rather than something exciting about your life. Yeah. I think a second part, it's not simply that there were so many divisions back then, which there were, but it seems for a lot of younger people, certainly the ones I teach, that it's total dysfunction at this point, that the idea of achieving almost anything on major priorities is impossible. And people will blame different things. They'll blame a radical Republican Party. They'll blame gerrymandering and money in politics. Take your pick. But the conclusion is the same. Why spend my life kind of, you know, going day to day, trying to deal with climate change through government policy when the answer is obvious, no legislation is going to pass. And I've had young people say this and they say, well, I'd rather go into finance and find ways to not just make money for myself, but to get money toward causes and toward organizations that do this kind of work. And I don't dismiss them. I understand it's a pretty rational response if you follow politics. And so I think you combine those two parts of American life that have been brewing for decades, and that would be the answer of why some younger people. And I'd say one other thing, and this is not based on my academic scholarship, but just watching students, is this inequality that has emerged in American life it means that at the very top, there's just a kind of unbound opportunity for smart, talented people. And I've seen this, you see this at certainly any Ivy League institution, but any quality institution, the best and brightest can make a lot of money. They have kind of a lot of incentive to go into the private sector because they'll probably do pretty well. And so government jobs and politics somehow has to overcome that as well. And they're never going to have the money. So it has to be a kind of cachet that right. politics no longer has. And so if your question is correct, and again, not everyone would agree, I would kind of cite those as some of the factors that push against a life of politics. Yep.
No, this is good because I both agree and disagree. Something I disagree on, and this just comes from personal experience with the age cohorts of politicians or aspiring politicians we're talking about. My reading of history is that humans are ambitious. We want things. And honestly, if you're choosing between a generic Wall Street banking job and running for office and you choose a Wall Street banking job, you're never going to be a great politician in the first place. I just know a lot of people who LARPed during college as, oh, I want to be a senator or a congressman. And then the first chance they got, they went to a T14 law school, are going to have a miserable life as a law partner and will forever talk about how they could have. But I think they never were going to in the first place. So I think maybe at a bureaucratic level. So if you look in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 30s, you're definitely going to find, no offense to any listeners who work in the government bureaucracy, you're going to find a weaker level of government bureaucrat relative to credentials. I totally can buy that. You know, an analyst at the Defense Department or at Treasury or at the Department of the Interior. I don't think that incentive is true from a political perspective. If you are a politician, you only get paid $174,000 a year. And once again, that's a lot of money for a lot of people. But if you are the type of person who could get elected to Congress or become a senator, you obviously have the ability to earn far more than that in any field. And that's always been true. So I don't think the financial or career accomplishment thing is quite as much of an explanation. Something though that I do think is an explanation, though, is what you said is about the dysfunction, which is it is just so dysfunctional that the type of person who you would want to have come in and who could be effective as a politician is much weaker. So Sagar, and I'll throw this back to you then, Julian, and basically say that when I was pushing back implicitly against your definition of good politician, I define good as effective. So what I mean by good is a politician who has an agenda, whose job it is to represent a coalition of voters or a party or institution. I do not think our current system encourages folks who could be effective politicians or people who could actually represent things well. I think our system either encourages hacky partisans, it encourages people who realize that the quickest way for a CNN panelist job or their own TV show or podcast is to get elected to office. We're looking at you, Madison Cawthorn, obviously, Ted Cruz, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then it also leads to people like AOC, which no beef with AOC, but AOC, I don't think is a deal maker. AOC is an activist. And she is. And I think part of the reason why she's not a particularly, she's a very effective social media influencer is she's an activist, but she's not actually, I think, equipped from a political education perspective or a coalitional perspective to actually enact anything she's talking about. So I'd just love to hear your response.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some validity to what that career path looks like and who's going to pick it and who's not going to pick it. I would say there is one other part of the story, though. I do meet a lot of young people who get into politics, actually. And I teach at the policy school. And the policy school are people who some went to Princeton, some went elsewhere. They come after working in some kind of political organization for 5-6 years. They come back for a 2-year master's program. And they're really remarkable people. And many of them don't choose a path of formal politics. And I think that is something that younger generations think about. They want to work in a nonprofit. They want to work in social movement politics, in NGOs. They just don't think that the only path toward affecting change is going to a state capitol or Washington, D.C. And so I do think there's a lot of the kinds of people you're talking about who you just don't find in elected office necessarily for all the reasons you outlined, but you can find doing very real things overseas and here in the United States. And I think that's the world where kind of younger generations are focused on right now. It's not an answer, because ultimately you need good people in politics. You need good elected officials. I also think you need lifetime government officials. It's certainly, you need people who are going to spend a long time there. It doesn't work 2 years in and out kind of thing. But I do think that's where a lot of the talent goes right now.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things is whenever people are like, we need term limits. I'm like, term limits ain't going to solve your problems, people. But like, I understand where it comes from, but it's really not what we're talking about. I think this is the question. Given your book, Newt Gingrich, the 1990s, Gingrich, for all of his faults, was a deeply policy-minded guy. He's not dumb. I've met him before. I've been in meetings with him. Smart. I have met some of the newer crop of GOP politicians and Democratic politicians, and that's just frankly not the case. These people don't know a damn thing about policy. They don't know anything about history. They can, people in Congress can barely tell you how a bill becomes a law or the history of the exact issue area of which they're trying to change. I've been stunned. I'm like, how do I know more about this than you? This is literally your job. So do you think policy still matters in politics? Whose fault is it if it doesn't? And what are the incentives for a politician to produce the people who I am talking about? And look, maybe I'm being too harsh, but at this point, I pretty much met almost all the politicians under 35, 40, or whatever who are in Congress. And I would say generally, that's who I'm describing here.
Well, I mean, policy always matters. That is the heart of what government does. So that never will change. Whoever is in or out, government produces policy, it administers policy, it implements policy. And so whether you're talking about Medicare and Social Security or infrastructure or military, that doesn't go away. And so the question really is, do you have officials, A, who have a grasp of policy, and B, who care if they do have a grasp, that should be a priority. The first part, you know, I don't know. I could imagine some of the people you're talking about, and that is a loss. I mean, you do hope that elected officials have some, they don't have to be academics or PhDs, but that they have some grasp of the issue areas that they're dealing with. And some of that comes from the temporal nature of elected office these days. I mean, I think you almost have a natural kind of term limit mentality setting in. And the lifetimers that Lyndon Johnson's generation represented, part of what came with that was a knowledge that you got by working there a long time. You couldn't work in Washington for decades and not have some sense of what Social Security was. You knew the history of policy because you lived through it. You were part of the debates. That's not the case for a lot of people anymore. They've only been in for a few years and they're leaving. They don't really consider it their home. So I think that might be why some of the talent pool and then all the other issues we're talking about. But there's another issue which is connected to Newt Gingrich. As smart as Gingrich was, and he's very smart and intelligent, and he does have knowledge of policy. One of his principal arguments to the GOP was to prioritize partisan strategy above all else. And he made this explicitly. The key is to win power. It's not about being focused on the needs of the institutions so that they work okay. You have to be civil. That kind of stuff didn't concern him. Governance was not ever his major concern. I mean, he didn't even serve on committees early on. He just didn't care about that. He said it. That's not what he wanted to do. And I think future generations of Republicans, for sure, down to this day, have made that a total priority. And even the smartest members, look, Ted Cruz, I would bet knows a lot about the issues he's talking about. Josh Hawley, I'm sure, knows what he's saying, but he's not prioritizing what would be necessary for him to be a conservative negotiating in the policy world. He is prioritizing partisan warfare. And that's why they'll say the things they do, which are like, come on, you know, we know you must know more than that. And that's the mentality of politics for them. And if you don't get out of that, they will never tap into the expertise that they might have. And they don't really care about doing that. That's really not, you know, you have Josh Hawley saying things about race in the country and how to teach history, which are just, he must know what he's saying as a very educated person, are pretty ridiculous in terms of what's going on in the classroom and what's necessary. But boy, does it play well when he's in front of those cameras. And I think that's a problem. And if we don't think differently, you're never going to get the kind of leadership you're talking about.
So this is interesting, though, because I feel the weird need to speak up for Newt Gingrich. It doesn't happen in many spaces often. So you're right. Newt Gingrich didn't serve on committees. He didn't prioritize many of the things that the LBJ standing we're doing today would suggest we think are really important. But at the same time, he helped Republicans win the House. So if the theme of this episode is that today, especially the culmination of everything since the 70s, is that politics is about power and wielding it in your coalition. Like, I understand from your perspective what you're saying about, you know, critical race theory and schools, but I also know that there's a huge portion of our audience that would say something like, well, look, we just totally disagree. We think that the right has no power over education. We think the New York Times is right in the 1619 Project, and there's obviously no conservative counterbalance to that. Whatever. You know, like, it's, people could think what they want, but there's clearly a power dynamic here. If Republicans hadn't followed Newt Gingrich's path, so there's a contradiction here, they would have remained a permanent minority in the House. They were the minority. You wrote about this in the book, obviously, and it's a very important part of the history. The Republican Party that in many ways you described before Gingrich, that in many ways he helped burn down, was an ineffective Republican Party. Yes, Reagan becomes president. Yes, Nixon blows out McGovern. But Reagan didn't really control Congress. Nixon was in many ways a very centrist president. If you're a conservative, it's very hard to look at the period of the 1960s and on a policy level, the 1980s. So not Reagan's aesthetic, but various things that just happened during that time period and be particularly happy with that. So what do you say to Republicans who say this history you're telling, Julian, is very convenient if you're a center left Democrat? Because if you're a center left Democrat, oh man, that sucks. Like, you controlled Congress for 40 years and now that's gone because Newt Gingrich burnt everything down. But now if you're a Republican, you say, look, maybe it might not be pretty, maybe it might not be everything I want, but at the same time, now I actually have an ability to influence policy in this country. So how do you think about that contradiction there?
Oh, that is at the core of what Gingrich would argue. He would say, yes, I did everything. I took down the guardrails. I burned down the House, but we won power. That's what he promised to do. And that's why he told all the Republicans, stop worrying about civility. Stop worrying about, will Congress work over the long term? Who cares? The key, if we're going to win, you have to do anything to win. And that is the mentality that he promoted. Yes, so it worked for sure. I mean, Republicans would eventually gain control, but you have to ask two questions. Kind of by letting down all the guardrails, which I do believe he was willing to do, and I believe that's only intensified through Donald Trump. You really kind of saw where that could go. It does, if you're not going to include that in your new coalition, if you're going to keep going for broke, there's dangers. I mean, it can create real dysfunction in government, and it can create an atmosphere where we can't handle issues which we really, really need to address. And it doesn't matter if you're center right, center left, left right, there's certain problems the country has. And I don't think right now Congress is capable of doing that. And so the question is, did the Republicans in taking back power have to also abandon everything else? And did they have to continue down that path where it kept getting more and more extreme? Because there's a high cost to that. And I don't know what Newt Gingrich would answer, and I don't know what many Republicans would answer, but I think it's an important question. The priority can't be winning power and nothing else matters. I think it has to be much more of a balance. Even Republicans in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they weren't totally ineffective. In Congress, they were very effective because they created coalitions with the Southern Democrats,
right,
and they had a big effect on policy. But someone like Everett Dirksen, who was a staunch conservative, who didn't like government, he was from Illinois, he was the Senate minority leader, he still believed that in the end of the day, He had to get things done. He had to work to govern. He had to work to get legislation through. So I think that's important. And look, there's another question. Can Republicans sustain this? Sure, it might be in the 80s and 90s it worked and they gained power. Let's remember, though, they've lost the presidency several times now. So it didn't totally work. They've lost control of Congress. They have not, in the Gingrich era, been able to do what Democrats did between the 30s to 70s, or really 30s to 90s, really generally have a lock on Congress. They can't do that. So there's something about this that might not be working as well as Gingrich said, and it hurts the Republicans because they can't totally remake power. And well, in the long term, there's this question, does this party, can it sustain itself in this fashion? If you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz as prominent legislators, does that mean that that's good for the party, just on a partisan level? And I think those are ways to at least open up normative questions about what Gingrich did, but also, is the story true that it was a total success?
But at the same time, we seem to be having a narrative here, which is very convenient for the Democratic Party. So I'll put on the other hat. Joe Biden barely won the presidency by 45,000 votes. The Senate is 50-50 because Trump is a joke and managed to lose two Senate seats in Georgia. And the House of Representatives, what's Pelosi's margin? 6 votes. And so if I'm a betting man, I'm going to say that the Senate is probably going to go red next year, and the House very likely too, just because of historical trends taking Biden out of it. And I would also say that the 2024 election, if Biden doesn't run, not looking good for the Democratic Party. Again, that's my opinion. So at the, 2008, Barack Obama wins probably the largest majority we're going to see in a divided time for a long time. He has a super majority in Congress. Sometimes I'll read books and it'll be like Democratic Senator from Arkansas. And I'm like, holy crap, there was a Democratic Senator from Arkansas like
just
10
years ago. So it's not even,
like,
yeah.
What? Or Louisiana? You're like, wait, there was a Democrat who represents. And I was in college like when this was happening. This was not that long ago. So at the same time, the Democratic Party has been totally routed in a large, basically rural parts of the country, barely won the American presidency here in 2020 after the literal plague year. Is the Democratic Party all that beneficial from these types of dysfunction, or does it just seem like we have dysfunction on all sides? What do you think?
Well, the problems you're raising with Democrats are fair. It is important to remember that it's hard to beat an incumbent president, and Obama didn't have to do that. And so they're often very narrow elections, and they can be very close, and the party of the president often does pretty well. Like when you look at it, we don't have clean sweeps in American politics. And so let's remember that
anymore,
Trump was—
at least.
Right. Right. And so, right now, since 84, really. And so Trump lost as an incumbent. And I think that is significant. And yes, it's narrow. It's narrow majorities, which we've had in the last 2-3 decades very often. This is part of American politics. There's a great book by a political scientist, Francis Lee, about insecure majorities, which is part of why partisanship becomes so strong in this country. So Democrats, I think, are still happy, even though it's narrow, even though I don't know what will happen in the midterms. I think your predictions could certainly be true. But they did win the presidency in the end, and they did have this 2-year window. And that's significant, especially since the economy was doing very well through the pandemic. It's kind of interesting. But you're right. It's not as if the Democrats are in great shape. And I think there's a lot of problems that the Democrats still need to wrestle with. And there's parts of the country which they're excited about. They're excited about Georgia. They're still excited about Texas, I think, in terms of what they're seeing. They're not excited about why rural, very rural America at this point seems to be lost. But I think your points are fair. And those are different kinds of questions about why the party couldn't achieve a bigger victory in 2020.
So for the last question here, I want you to recount, because it'd be very valuable for the audience, a bit of what Newt Gingrich's rise looked like during the 80s. So you hinted at it with the, wasn't paying attention to committees, was very active on the messaging front, because I think the strongest just apolitical take about Gingrich that I took away from the book is just this idea that, man, this guy is a brilliant political entrepreneur. So value neutral. He saw all the strings tying everything together. He saw the vulnerabilities. He saw how the system could be different. He had a vision, he had a plan, and he acted on that. So going back to the earlier question of good politicians and bad politicians, I'd say from a political perspective, he's a good politician. That doesn't lead to good things, obviously, but it's that. Could you recount that story and then look at basically the state of the country, the state of Congress today, and think about how good ambitious politicians would look at this today. So for example, something that was big for Gingrich was videos, video cassettes through his PAC that he would send out where he was talking about messaging, all those things. If he was young, he would have a podcast, as people like Senator Ted Cruz do, as a variety of folks do this, et cetera. He would have a big Twitter account like AOC. So can you just recount Gingrich's story? And then at least without need to make predictions, how do you think a ambitious, good politician would look at the sort of wreckage of that burnt down house today and think about the opportunities they have in front of them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Gingrich's story is about this guy from Pennsylvania who ends up in Georgia. His stepdad is in the army, so he travels around Europe and he gets a PhD in history in Tulane, and he ends up going, though, into politics. He doesn't like academics, and he serves as a representative from Georgia, and he wins his seat in 78. And fundamental to his story, it turns out people saw him in his first few years in the House of Representatives in the late 70s, early 80s. He's seen as a real maverick, a dangerous force, that he's a bomb thrower, that this is a guy who will do and say anything. He'll take down people's careers within a second. He has no hesitation to just devastate the opposition. And many Republicans don't like him. Democrats certainly don't like him. And he's almost like a Joe McCarthy. That's how many people talk about him. Again, even Republicans. But he makes this argument that we've referred to, that Republicans had been a permanent minority, and that if they're not much more aggressive, if they don't embrace a kind of partisanship which seemed dangerous to many people at the time, they wouldn't win. And my story goes how he does that, from doing these stunts on C-SPAN, where he attacks the national security credentials of Democrats in front of an empty chamber, but viewers think it's full because the C-SPAN cameras only cover the person speaking, to bringing down the Speaker of the House on nothing ethically wrong, a guy named Jim Wright, but kind of questionable things in his career, just took him down. Even as Gingrich himself was under investigation for things that were literally almost the same. And that's the story. By the end of the 80s, he's not a maverick. He's not McCarthy. He's the power broker. So I think political entrepreneur, power broker, that's the key to the story. I see him that way. He understood and exploited elements of politics that were right there in front of everyone, but people either didn't see or they didn't want to do. And in 94, he becomes Speaker of the House, and he brings his style to the leadership of the GOP rather than it remaining on the sidelines. And he understood parts of politics. He understood how the 70s and the 60s had created immense distrust in politics. And he used that against Democrats. While Democrats talked about Nixon, he talked about congressional Democrats and said they were a corrupt establishment. And he understood how that argument would really resonate. He took reforms that had been enacted after Watergate to make politics better, like ethics rules to make sure members disclosed where they made money and that they couldn't do whatever they wanted outside of their jobs. And he weaponized them to use them against the Democratic leadership, to use them in an aggressive fashion that the creators of the rules never even imagined. And finally, and your podcast comment kind of gets to that, he understood what was happening in the media. He understood by the 80s, television was the king of the hill, and that the way to get to voters, the way to go after opponents wasn't, going into the cloakroom and having negotiations. And it wasn't working behind the scenes. It was getting on TV and simply eviscerating your opponent with those cameras rolling, because after you said something, there was no way anyone was going to take it back. And also videotapes and talk radio. He got all of that, and he used it very well. And so whether you like him or dislike him, and people who read my book, this is a conversation, many people don't like him. But I always say the heart of the book is this guy was a political entrepreneur, and he was incredibly effective. And so I think the question
key thing, which we didn't hit, he's overthrown as speaker. So we should actually know that this actually doesn't end well for him.
It's not a good story.
From a political perspective.
No, he's the only speaker for 4 years. He's brought down in 1998. He is fined in 97 for ethics violations. So this is one of the things people dislike about Gingrich is he's not genuine about his concerns for ethics. He uses it because he himself is always either under investigation or just guilty of exactly what he accuses others of. Here's a guy who's part of a conservative party aligned with the religious right and talking about virtue, and he has many affairs, and he has a very scandalous personal life. He attacks Democrats for their ethics. Well, he's constantly under investigation and even fined for ethics violations. And finally, in 98, he only lasts 4 years, he is brought down. That said, that's the system he wanted to create. He wanted to create a system where no one was safe, where every leader could be brought down. And in a Shakespearean fashion, that's exactly what happened to him. But I think the way in which he did understand kind of bigger phenomenon and connected them to partisan strategy is something that is a kind of ongoing lesson, I think, for any Democrat or Republican, even in this day and age.
I think that's right. Well, sir, we really appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us. It's not about like or dislike. It's about understanding. You want to work in politics. You want to understand politics. You got to understand what happened with Newt Gingrich. So I think that's what your book does. It'll be available on our bookshop, and we really appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
And just the obvious question, it'd be great for you to shout out the book. Anything else that people should check out, of course.
Well, the book's Burning Down the House. I hope people, it's out in paperback now. You can follow me on Twitter at Julian Zelizer. And I have another book coming out in October on something very different, on a rabbi, Abraham Heschel, who is part of the civil rights and anti-war movement in the 1960s. That'll be out in October.
There we go. Awesome. Thank you, sir. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. As we point out at the top of the show, you can find us on Substack. You could go to the bookshop to check out Burning Down the House. And of course, you could rate us 5 stars and submit your questions. We love hearing them. We'll see you next time. And of course, a huge closing thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work.